Now it is time for you to help me welcome our speaker, which is Jimmy D. from Philadelphia. His home group is the 309 Step Study at the Unity Clubhouse on Thursday nights at 7. Jimmy D.
Okay. How you doing? My name's Jimmy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jimmy.
All right. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I grew up in Philadelphia. I was actually born in Kensington. And we moved up to the Northeast, Parkwood Manor. I had two loving parents. My home was not a dysfunctional home. My neighborhood was very dysfunctional. It seemed like half the element from Kensington had moved to Parkwood. The hopes, my parents' hopes were that we would move away from that, and it didn't work out too well. I'm a cement mason by trade. February 2nd, it just passed. I celebrated 9 years, and I have a 15-year-old daughter. And that's pretty much my basic background. My father is a fireman. His father was a fireman. And they were about hard work, no angles, no cut, no angles. You just get up, you go to work, you provide for your family, and that's it. And there was no, although my grandparents, my grandfathers suffered from this disease, my mother didn't, nor did my father. But I'm sure they were affected by the untreated disease of their parents. The disease runs heavier on my mother's side of the family, and it made its way to me, I believe, from birth. And its symptoms, I think, were there from the very beginning. Everything about me from Jump Street had the underlining behaviors of the disease. When we moved up to Parkwood, I was a kid, and I gravitated to a playground, and I guess I was like 10 years old by the time I got to this playground, and we stayed there for about 11 years after that. It was just like, by the time I made it there, there was a lot of dysfunction already going on. There was a lot of guys selling stuff. There was a lot of drinking, and it really looked good to me. It was very attractive. I thought that that was awesome. I couldn't wait till it was my turn to be that guy. There was a neighborhood bar up at the shopping center, and I can remember when we were real little, like maybe 7, going to the store for my mom and dad and walking up there with other kids. In the summertime, the door to the bar would be open, and we'd run by it. Like, you know, we were afraid to go by it because there was always some kind of drama spilling out. And we ran by, and I ran by with the rest of the kids, like, you know, but I was attracted to it. I couldn't wait to get in there. There was something about that atmosphere in there that already had me, you know, and I didn't, you know, I never really understand it. I didn't even recognize it as an attraction then. It's probably, you know, not till later years that I realized that there was something that appealed to me about that. The disease took off with me right away. I remember the first time I drank. I remember it was April. I remember I was 12 or 13. I can't remember exactly. I know it was April. It was springtime. It was really nice day, and we were at the baseball field behind the playground where I hung out, and we were on the bleachers, and we went three ways on a case of Jenny Cream Ale. And I didn't really have. A lot of people say, oh, I remember the first one, it felt this, it fixed me, it did all that. I don't remember that happening at that point. What was, you know, very clear to me was the progression, you know. Like I said, it was April, can of Jenny Cream Ale, and it was Oxford Detox in September, Matchhead PCP. It was like that quick. I just wanted to try and use and experiment and go with everything. You know, and as life went on and we were using and all of us hung out and we all drank and we all experimented and we all did things, but none of us really had any money. We were too young to work at that time, so we made money any way we could. And at the time, the things I was doing to make money, later on I viewed them as kind of being a scumbag, but at the time it was just like things that happened, you know, stealing car stereos and robbing stores and things like that. And a lot of that stuff took place, and a lot of it was kind of acceptable. But what wasn't acceptable was a lot of the kids grew out of that, and I kind of hung on to that petty theft attitude as I started getting older. And, you know, the disease really, it lies to us a lot, and I'll get into that later, but I really thought I was a bona fide gangster, man, on my way. I really believed that. I thought that was where I was supposed to be. That's what I wanted to do. And I really felt like as if I had no choice in that. That was supposed to be my destiny. And the example I had at home, it was like it didn't exist. You know, it was like it wasn't even there. And when shit hit the fan, and a lot of times I had to answer to somebody, whether it was a school counselor, disciplinarian, cop, or my parents, I was like, what do you expect? That's all I know. And they were like, no, that's not all you know. You choose to hang with these people. You choose to find your way. You make poor choices. You make decisions that are bad for yourself. And I can remember hearing that at a young age, you know. And I heard that. I still hear it. I still do. You know what I mean? I still make poor decisions. I try not to, you know. I try to look at things differently, but I'm human, and that's what happens. It's usually when I'm acting out selfishly that I make the poor decisions. But back then, no matter what decision I made, it was going to be poor, you know, because that's where my thinking was. You know, it was either bad or worse. It was never the right choice. School was a nightmare for me. School, I had dyslexia. I still have it. I was very severe dyslexia. And in the 70s, in public school in Philadelphia, there was really, nobody was diagnosing you with that shit. And there was really no, there wasn't a lot of alternative tools and things like that for them to deal with learning disability. So we got grouped together into emotionally disturbed classes, and that started a lot of now I got this one life where I'm supposed to be cool out here with all my friends, and this other life at school where I'm supposed to be riding this yellow bus and you know, going to see a psychiatrist and doing all this other stuff. And I really tried like hell to separate those things, and I did that with a lot of anger and behavior problems. And I got myself thrown out of school on purpose so I didn't have to hide that from the guys on the corner. You know what I mean? Got into high school, and, you know, I was using the whole time, and I ended up dropping out of that. Let me back up a little bit. My mom, and my father, I guess, too, but my mom, she had been exposed to alcoholism, and more importantly, and I believe it saved my life, was she had been exposed to Al-Anon. So when I started doing my thing, she was like, you're not going to do it here, you know. So I would use, or I got caught with something, and I would get grounded, and I would just go out, you know. I would just leave the house, and I'd go out anyway. And then I'd come home off my load. I'd figure I'd hear their shit again, and you know, I'd get grounded again, and then I'd just go out. That was my system for it. I figured out, I'd just keep grounding me. I'll just keep doing what I want, right? Well, my father came home from work, and he said, listen, you're either going to do what I want you to do, or you're not going to live at my house. And he threw me out. And, you know, I was like one of the times I remember really being scared, because I was, you know, I was probably 14 or 15 at that time, you know. And what happens is like, you come back with your tail between your leg, and you start yesing people to death, and you do whatever they say. And at the time, it was, you need to go to an outpatient program, you know. And I blew a urine there, and, you know, of course, they told my parents, and then, you know, then they throw you back out, and then, and it started being trips to regular rehabs, you know, and 28-day places, and I went to this one place up in upstate Pennsylvania called Clearbrook Lodge in Shikshany, PA, and they sent me up there, and I thought it was great. It was a vacation. I really thought that, you know. But one thing they did, I learned up there, was they lectured us every day on the disease, you know, and they taught us about that. And it kind of ruined a lot of shit for me after I left there. And, I had kind of, like, diagnosed myself. Now when I was getting loaded on the street, I'm like, I could see the progression. And I knew I was progressing in my using, and I knew, you know, that things were going to get worse. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to stop, you know, and, and things did get worse, and I ended up in a detox another time, you know, and then I swore that I was going to do things right, and I got back in the house, and I think it was like I was 16 where I got thrown out for the last time, and that's the last time I ever remember living at home. And then it was just kind of like bouncing around, living at friends' houses or going down the shore and spending the summer down the shore. And then, you know, I would try to get some kind of hustle or game together for the wintertime to get back into somebody's house, you know. I wasn't necessarily going to get to my parents. The whole time, my crimes that I started doing started getting worse. I started doing armed robberies and things like that. But most of them were against people that were selling stuff in the neighborhood. They weren't really against any particular business. But this one time we did, we robbed the McDonald's on the turnpike. And we wore masks when we did it, so we really couldn't be identified. But something happened, and people started getting, there was two guys that I did it with. They got locked up. And I panicked, right? I think I was like 18 now. So I panicked. And there was this place called the Firehouse at 2nd and Norris in Philly. It was a long-term rehab. And somebody said, you need to check yourself into a rehab now, and you can use that against your defense when you get in front of the judge. You've never been locked up before. It'll work out. So that's what I did. So I checked myself into this program. And you talk about just weird twist of fate. Somebody else burglarized that McDonald's before we robbed it. They found his thumbprint, and they thought that the other guy in the mask was the guy that burglarized it, not me. So they never came after me. Well, I spent 3 months in this rehab, and after I found out they weren't coming after me, I split. The heat's off, right? So I've been there for 3 months now. I'm back on the street, and I got loaded. And I, first time in my life, I can remember feeling disappointed in myself about, like, I don't know if it was that I started realizing I really was powerless at that point, or I didn't know, but I thought at that point I really wanted to be sober, and when I got loaded, something really hit me hard there, and I didn't know what to do. So I stayed out for a couple days. I ended up starting to go to meetings. I started going to another fellowship because I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I got involved with it, with service. And we were joking about this the other night. When I got involved with this service, they were real into the traditions and shit like that. They weren't too much into recovery or steps. But you know what? We got involved in service, and I started memorizing some traditions, and that was great for me because it was great for my ego to be able to spout off those traditions and dig into some controversy in the business meetings and really start a bunch of shit. And I liked doing that, you know? I liked doing that. Plus, I was only like 20, 22 at the time, and then I managed to do that for like 5 years. And somewhere along the lines, I thought, you know what? I think I can sell shit on the street and stay sober at the same time, right? And that's always, no matter how many times I tried to get sober, the lure of fast money is what took me out first. I started doing things illegal, and then I ended up using. It wasn't like an obsession first, and then I got loaded. That happened, but not till later down the road. So anyway, I ended up getting loaded again, you know, through the course of that, and things were bad. And I was an adult now. And remember, I thought I was a gangster, right? But really, what I was up at that point was, in my neighborhood, I was a public nuisance, to be completely honest with you. I was no gangster. I was no tough guy. I was a petty thief, and I was a public nuisance, you know, it wasn't anything real glamorous. I went into a blackout. My parents had left. They moved to San Diego. I went into a blackout, and I ended up down the projects at 2nd Washington in South Philly, and I was out of it pretty good. And apparently I called my friend who had been in the other program still and told him, I can't do this anymore. Well, he must have called my dad, and between them they came up with the idea that I would be better off out there. So I woke up on a plane landing in San Diego out of a blackout, and I couldn't believe it. You know, that was the last place I wanted to be. I thought it was square. I thought it was corny. I didn't want to leave the city. So not being functional, I got there. I lasted about a week at my parents' house. I was back on the street in San Diego, and I stayed there for 5 years. Getting loaded, in and out, and, you know, hitting meetings and ended up going back out, AA meetings, in and out. And then at one point, I white-knuckled a year. I white-knuckled a year together. I scraped together airfare, and I flew back to San Diego, or back to Philadelphia. And somewhere in there at that time, with that little bit of white-knuckle time, I convinced this girl to marry me. And I ambushed her with the whole disease thing. You know what I mean? This girl, she had no idea about addiction or progression or powerlessness or anything. I don't think she had been ever exposed to it. She was from North Jersey in a gated community, and her father was vice president of Time Warner, you know, and I convinced her to move in with me in the city, and it was crazy for her once I started using. We had a baby, you know, a little girl, and, you know, the progression took over. I started drinking. It started out like, listen, I want to drink. I work all week. I want to drink. You know what I mean? I was a man. I'm a union cement mason. I'm a man. I go to work. I work overtime. Everything I do for this family, it's happy hour. I'm drinking. You don't like it too bad. Well, again, I never really paid attention to the consequences, what really was going on around me. Like, I didn't know my parents were ready to throw me out, you know what I mean, until they actually threw me out. And I really wasn't paying attention to what was going on here. And what was going on there was she was hooking up with my buddy, and I didn't know it. He didn't drink like I drank. I guess that was the attraction. I don't know. He drank. I drank at the bar with him, but I don't think he stayed out for 4 days when he drank. You know what I mean? I was home one night with my daughter, and she was really young. And my wife wasn't home, and I just had this feeling, and I don't know what it was. I got my daughter out of bed, I put her in the car seat, and I drove over to this dude's apartment, and I circled around his building, and I was like, all right, good, the car's not there. And I'm just about ready to pull out of this apartment complex. I said, let me drive around this next building, maybe the car's stashed around back. And there was my car, and my heart just sunk, man. It just went right down. So the way their apartments were situated, I pulled up at the curb, and there was a front door, and there was a set of steps, and there was another door at the top. So I got out. I opened up my car door. I kicked in that door. I ran up the steps. I kicked in the other door, and he was hiding in the bathroom, and she was kind of, you know, spewing off with all this drama. And for a moment of sanity happened at that point, like the rage passed after I kicked in the other door. I looked down. I could see my daughter sleeping in the car seat. It's 2 in the morning. I'm in Jersey, right? This is in Jersey, too. I'm thinking, they're locking my ass up. And I just said, I'm out of here. And I went. I put my daughter back in bed. And anyway, she rolled. She had enough. They rolled. She took my daughter and rolled. And I'm in the house now. They're gone. I'm in a big tailspin now, you know. I'm like 40 years old at this time, and things are starting to get shut off. The phone's getting shut off. Gas is getting shut off, you know. And I'm at this house using by myself for another year and a half in the dark. And you know it's bad when you still don't come home for 4 days on a load when you live by yourself. You know what I mean? It was just like I couldn't get it together, man. I mean, some days I remember I'd come home and I would sit down on that couch. It'd be like 4 in the morning. And I'd look down. And I'm like, holy shit! I still got my work boots on. It's been like days, you know. February's always been a tough month. I guess because of the line of work I'm in, concrete industry. There's always not a lot of money. Without a lot of money, you're kind of feeling depressed. There's not always that money there to feed your habits, so you're really banged up. You know we can't stand ourselves sober, right? So I guess it's no, you know, miracle that I got it in February, February 2nd, right? It's Groundhog's Day, too. How about that, right? Chronic relapser gets sober on Groundhog's Day. So, you know, I'm out plowing this one night, and you know, I got plenty of money. I'm out drinking because you have plenty of shit when you're plowing snow all night. And it's 10:30 the next morning. I pull up to this bar, and I get an absolute and 7. I drank half of it, and I was just like, I'm done. I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore. And the thought that came to my mind at that point was, if I don't quit now, my daughter's going to know who I am. And what I am, and that scared the shit out of me. So I went home because I was banged up on other stuff too at this point, and I detoxed on my couch for 4 days, and then I went to a meeting on a Thursday night, and it was a penny pack group. It was a clubhouse. So I got there, and I sat down in that chair. And it was a metal folding chair, and I sat down in it, and I started seeing stuff on the walls, think, first things first. And I started hearing people share, and they were using some of the cliches we use. And I was like, what a pathetic bunch of losers, I thought to myself. I'm like, I can't believe this is what I got to do to get my life together. I am so sick of this. I was so angry, and I felt so... You know, you got to remember, I was 13 at my first meeting. I'd been in and out for many, many years. And by this time, I just had it, you know. And I was disgusted with myself and where my life had become. Because, other guys use and spend the bill money on dope and drinking, and their kids leave them, and they don't provide for the family. Not me. That's how I really thought. No, I'm not that guy. I don't do that. And I was that guy. I remember sitting in that meeting on a Thursday night, feeling the way I felt, that banged up. And I went back the next night, and I went back the next night, and I went back the next night until it was the following Thursday. And I was sitting in that chair, and I was overwhelmed with gratitude. You know, it took a little while for me to recognize the opportunity I had in front of me. And I was overwhelmed with gratitude. AA never really worked for me before, was my thinking at that point. But I had enough. That day in that bar was the last time I had any desire to ever get loaded up until today. And that was by the grace of my higher power. But that wasn't the end of the insanity. See, because I really thought... I really thought that what I was going to do was I was going to come around, I was going to hit some meetings, I was going to bebop around, hit a few dances. Maybe I was just going to do the first three steps because I really thought I was a mild case. I wasn't like everybody else. I didn't need to do all them. I don't need to do the fifth step. I don't need to make amends. Yeah, I'll do the first three steps. That's pretty cool. I'll pray. You know, maybe I'll speak. I'll take a chair. You know, I'll do stuff like that. And but I don't need to do all that other crap, you know. And that's what I did. And I started getting into – I was a Union Cement Mason, right? And I wore that label. That was my identity. Well, I was so dysfunctional, I lost that. I got suspended from that. I was working for my last year as a cement mason in using – before I was suspended, I made $67,000. I was working for a handyman for 85 hours a day when I made it back to the rooms. And after I got like a week sober, I started cleaning up, started getting things together, got a truck running. By the spring, I started doing side work. You know, things started picking up for me. Things got even better. More work was coming my way. More money was coming my way than I ever had at one time. So what I did was I teamed up with another alcoholic. The both of us were completely dysfunctional. I'm in a sober house at this point. We start this company. I don't know what happened, but we kind of just fell into it. Next thing you know, we had 29 employees. I was signed with two different unions. I had a crane downtown with a banner on the side with our name, and I was handing out T-shirts so everybody knew that was my job site. My ego was like this, right? We were going to be millionaires. My electricity was shut off at home at that time, still, because I was so dysfunctional and so insane and so still suffering from the untreated disease. I couldn't stand the unmanageability. I might have been behind on tuition at that time. I got the aggravation from my ex-wife. I was broke when my daughter came to see me. We couldn't really go any places. And then it hit me. I didn't want to use, but I didn't want to live anymore, man. I remember running a machine at work thinking, I would love for this machine to just get hooked on a piece of metal and throw me off the building. I didn't want to live anymore. I wanted to die, but I didn't necessarily want to commit suicide. I just wanted the pain to stop. So a friend of mine that we were enjoying this sober life with, we thought sobriety was about smoking cigars and having steak dinners and all that stuff. He had went through the steps. So he approached me a couple times and said, let me take you through the steps. You know, and we'd go down Shore House, down his Shore House. Our kids would play together. And we spent a lot of quality time with each other. And when he started talking to me about the steps and saying, let me take you through the steps, he started getting weird. You know, I started thinking, this dude's weird, man. What happened? You know, and I didn't want to be rude. We were down at Shore House. We were hanging out. You know what I mean? So I would let him take me through the first three steps. And I tell you, I was trying to stay awake by the third step. You know what I mean? I felt uncomfortable. It wasn't for me. But I figured I'd throw him a bone and let him take me through the steps. Right? So we did that, you know, and he gave me the four-step guide, told me about it, and I bailed. I hadn't talked to him for 3 months after that, right? But then that day I was just telling you about at work where I felt like dying, hitting the pain, was crazy and everything. See, I'd been going to step studies. Don't ask me why. And it was apparent to me the person talking about the steps was absolutely talking about the truth and absolutely talking to me. But for whatever reason, with our disease, it doesn't let us jump like that. You know what I mean? It's that window wasn't there for me right then. But when I had those thoughts of dying, they were there. So I called my buddy Mike up, and I said, Mike, you got to take me through the steps, man. You got to. I can't do it. And this guy, I mean, he had, you know, he has two kids, his wife and everybody were at his house. And he says, I went over there, and he told his wife, he says, look, can you take the kids to the meeting for a while? I'm going to need some time with Jimmy. And I was like, you know what I mean? like I recognized how huge that was at that point to do that, you know, just, you know, disrupt their day. You know, they're look, everybody's look, you know, disrupt their home. And we sat down for about 5 hours, took me through the first three steps, took me through the fourth step, the fifth step. And I had to go home and sit quietly for an hour when I did the fifth step. And then when I was done that, I remember picking up the phone. I'm like, yo, what's up with the six and seven? You know, and I wanted to do that. And I went back and we went through the steps. But, he taught me so much about the steps, right? And I didn't understand what he was teaching me, man. But I did understand this because I was baffled for a long time. I never knew how AA worked. How does AA work? What do? You just go to meetings and you talk about your problems and other people talk about the problems, and that's supposed to keep you sober. It wasn't working for me. That didn't work. And we were talking about this the other night, too. People were, they would say, listen, dude, if you're still getting loaded, you got to turn that shit over to God. You just got to pray. And I would pray all meeting. I would take phone numbers. I'd ask God to remove the obsession, and I'd leave the meeting, and I'd go get loaded. It wasn't until I started going through the steps that I realized that I was unable to use my higher power. You know, the third step at that point is just a decision, right? Can't really turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And I didn't understand that. I just thought the third step didn't work for me. It's, I don't know why, but it's not working. I didn't realize that I had just tremendous amounts of debris blocking me off from my higher power in the form of resentment and anger and fear and guilt and remorse. And there was, you know, the steps were something we had to do in full circle. I was never going to get to that point unless I went through the rest of the process. So, you know, he explained to me that I am cut off from my higher power. And for me to start to feel relief and start to feel the presence of my higher power, I needed to go through 4 and 5. Like, you know, to him it was immediate, meant immediately. Like, if you're at the third step and you're willing to make that decision, then it's time to do 4 and 5 after that. Right? It's there is no wait or no lull. It's like, if you can get somebody to that point, then it's time for them to write their fourth step out, right? And I had did 4 steps in the past, but they were like some kind of journal and long confession of a bunch of crazy thoughts that I really couldn't make sense of when it was time to do my fifth step anyway. When I sat down with him, he handed me the guide. He said, just write in the names of the people you don't like. And then that was real easy for me. And then we went through the list, and he started explaining to me, you know, mom and dad, brother, sister, and then everybody else. And it became apparent to me that I had spent my life destroying relationships. Any relationship I had, any person that I came in contact with, whether it was casual, friendly, a relative, an employment, whatever it was, brother, sister, mother, father, girlfriends, wives, everything. I destroyed those relationships. You know, if you got involved with me, you came up shorthanded. I always took more than I gave. I just wasn't capable of it. I was spiritually sick, you know, and selfish, and I could not recognize that. Once it was on paper, it was pretty hard not to recognize. You know, it got to the point, you're down in like the fifth one, you're like, all right, I get it now, yeah. No, we're going through it. No, we got to go through them all, you know, and then my amends, I had to write my amends out, and my sex conduct blew my mind because I had no idea it was really just how I was treating the opposite sex. You know what I mean? It didn't really have anything to do with sex for me. It was, you know, creating that jealousy or that bitterness or that insecurity and that suspicion from the tears I went on, or just staying out, or phone numbers that would be found. And, you know, I just thought sex conduct at that point was lying and manipulating your partner, and it kind of was, but there was so much more to learn about at that point. It was, you know, because what we were learning then, we were going over fifth step material at that point, but what we were doing was creating new way of dealing with these relationships, and I needed it, right? I needed it desperately because I was like a freight train, man, and I just ran through your life and our relationship, and it got shattered, you know. And my sponsor told me, listen, we're not going to burn that four step. You're going to need that. Don't throw that away. you know, forget about everything you ever heard about the program, and we're going to do what's in print. And he said, nowhere in that fourth step we just covered it did it say burn it. So don't burn it. Don't rip it up. Hold on to it. And I needed that information for 6 and 7, all right? I needed to go back over that stuff on my shortcomings and my defects, you know what I mean? And at 6, I was going to ask God to get me to be willing to get rid of these things. And at 7, I was going to ask him to remove the things that were willing. It's funny how those, I thought they were gimmies, you know, 6 and 7. Oh, look how small they are. I got that. Come on, let's move on. He's like, dude, you're going to be butchering those two for the rest of your life, man. You know what I mean? They're always going to be there. So, you know, and they are. They're always there. They show up in 10 all the time, right? So we started making amends. You know, I got to my list. My list came from my four-step, right? It just added a lot to it. And I still add stuff to it. There's things that happen in the course of my day, and I think back and I'm like, holy shit, I owe that dude an amends. Like, there's situations once that I looked at as being completely innocent in whatever the issue was, to immediately seeing my wrongs. And just a passing thought, and I have to add that person to my list. So I made the list, and my list was divided in three separate columns. Amends that were easy to make, amends that were going to be hard to make, and amends I wasn't going to make at all. And it was a lot easier because I had my amends list was on the backside of my four-step guy too, right? There wasn't enough space on the front, and there was a lot of names on the back, and once I did that, it didn't seem so overwhelming. Now, when I started making my amends, I never understood those AA promises, right? Every year, everybody read, and it's really the ninth step promises. I had no idea what the hell they were talking about. I'm like, be amazed before you're halfway through. And I'm like, halfway through what? Halfway through my 90 and 90? I guess once I'm halfway through my 90 and 90, I'll intuitively know how to handle things that used to baffle me or something, right? Like, I didn't know. My sponsor was like, nah, dude, it's halfway through your amends list. Once you start making these amends, things, you know, and he explained the importance of them, you know. And as I studied the book, I came to the realization, this is just me, this is an AA, but I think it's irresponsible to read those ninth step promises in a meeting without elaborating on how they're achieved. Because I really thought when I heard them, it was about attendance. And you can say, yeah, it is if you find your way into the book, but there's really no emphasis on that. Nobody really explains to you what it is you have to do to get to that point. So the ninth step was so important to me because that's where I experienced my spiritual awakening, was in the midst of my ninth step. And in the book, it talks about the man you hate. Well, the man I hate was the guy whose door I kicked in. And my sponsor told me I had to make amends to that dude. And that blew me away. I was like, he hooked up with my wife. Why do I got to make amends to him? And because I took every opportunity. This guy, by the way, I've been separated and divorced longer than I was married now at this point in time. And he's still in her life. You know, in fact, I have a kid together now of their own. And, you know, I made the last couple years before I went through the book very uncomfortable for him at any chance I could get, right? And there was a lot of resentment and a lot of me staying sick holding on to this resentment. I had my daughter every weekend. And if I had to drop my daughter off, it was Sunday, I'm getting ready to drop my daughter off. I got a 45-minute ride to Jersey. My daughter's in the back seat, sitting in the car seat, cute little pigtails, and she's talking. And I'm looking at her in the mirror, and I can see her mouth moving, and I can't hear a word she's saying because I'm thinking about killing this dude when I drop her off. I'm just like, I am unavailable emotionally for her. I can't think about her. I can't be involved in it. The book says that's squandering time, right? I'm squandering that time with her. And And then I would think, oh, when I get there, man, if I'm going to grab a stew by the throat, I got to do it because the neighbors can see and they're going to know that I just let this dude punk me like that. And the insanity diseases, they have a house now. Those neighbors don't even know, you know what I mean, anything that ever happened beforehand. But in my head, they knew everything, you know what I mean? And in my head and my ego, they were making a fool. They thought I was a fool, you know? So anyway, I went in. I never set foot in their house for 2 years. I would pull up, open up the car door. My daughter would run up to the house, or she'd run out of the house into my car. So my sponsor tells me I got to make amends to this dude, right? And I'm scared to death to go back to the way I was living, so I'm going to make amends. I got to say this, man. When I started my steps, I stayed pretty willing. And that's definitely a gift from my higher power. So I got up there. And I knocked on her door. I said, Jen, listen, is Aaron home? She's like, yeah, why? I said, I got to talk to him. About what? I said, listen, nothing's going to happen. I just need to talk to him. And I went in there. And, you know, my sponsor said there's no saying you're sorry. He said, you got to say you were wrong. I'm like, I was wrong. I got to say I'm wrong? He said, yeah, you got to say you were wrong. I was wrong for my former ill feelings, you know, that I have for this guy. I had to say I was wrong. I had to ask him. Now I'm drawing a blank on my four things. I had to ask him if there was anything else I did. You know, I had to ask him, how can I make it right? And help me out. What was the fourth thing I had to do? Can you find it in your heart to forgive me? The whole amends. That was the one that set me free right there, man. You know, can you find it in your heart to forgive me? And I told my sponsor, I don't talk like that. I can't say those things. He goes, yeah, that's why people are going to listen to you. Because you don't talk like that. You always used to say you were sorry. So I got up there. I said those things. And I was right in his face when I said them right there. And right there in her living room, I had my spiritual awakening. It was unbelievable. Anytime I read spiritual awakening in a book right now, I think of being in her living room. Anytime I hear people talk about spiritual awakening, I think about being in her living room. That's where everything happened for me, you know. I told my sponsor about it. We made a few more amends, and then he told me it was time for 10. And a 10 was some other confusion for me because I was your 10-step inventory, I thought was like something that we did daily, and it was more of a spot check inventory and an inventory of whatever role I just played and whatever drama or confusion I just caused, you know. And he also told me that there's always going to be conflict and confusion, and these things are going to pop up. It's my reaction to that is where we're at now with it, right? And that's what we're addressing. I don't like making amends. I don't. So, you know, a lot of times just the fact that I might have to make an amends keeps my mouth shut sometimes. You know what I mean? Other times it's digging in with my higher power. And other times it's just simply because I got something now that I once thought was very corny. It didn't exist at the playground. I never heard people mention it before. And if they did, I thought they were like geeky or something, and that's peace of mind. You know, I always heard people talk about peace of mind, and I just thought, who the hell is peace of mind? Right? I've experienced peace of mind, and I value it. I don't want to lose it. It's noisy up here when there's no peace of mind, and it hurts, and I don't like it anymore. And, you know, so I really try to adhere to this stuff as best I can. And when I got to the 11th step, that's where I found out that was my daily inventory. You know, there was more confusion for me about the book. At night, you know, page 86, that's just not a paragraph. There's a lot of questions involved with that. And we inventory our day with that page. And, you know, I found out I was praying wrong. You know, I found out that most of my prayers were selfish up to this point. I found out all my prayers were a one-way conversation to this point. It was me talking to God. It wasn't until I got to meditation and it was explained to me that's the listening. That's the inspiration behind everything. That's where we find our direction, is through meditation. And, you know, in the morning, very important for us to meet that meditative state. And, you know, I think we're all like this. We have to start clearing our head for the morning meditation the night before, right? We got to put that stuff to bed. We got to realize, we got to analyze things and know where our amends got to be made, or where we can do things better, or where our focus should be the next day. Then when we get up, we do the same thing. We inventory our day on what it's going to be like, right? And then we find out that whatever we had planned isn't necessarily what our higher power had planned for us, and then we have to make some adjustments to that, right? But after we do that, that's when we get quiet, and that's where we try to get to that meditative state. And it takes a lot of practice, and it's unavailable for me a lot of days if I already have. Like, resentments come and go. Like, the resentments I dealt with my ex-wife and the amends that I made in the past, if I don't stay spiritually fit, those resentments creep back in. You know what I mean? I'm dealing with my daughter, and I'm dealing with my ex-wife, and sometimes there's conflict in there. On days that I'm spiritually fit, I blow it off. On days that I'm not spiritually fit, she's a bitch again, she's this, that, she's dysfunctional. Like, I'm taking her inventory, and it's hard to get to that meditative state, man. I'm in a bad way. You know, so we have to come back again, inventory ourselves, and try and get our heads right so we get to that. When we get there is when we make that conscious contact with a higher power, right? The 4 and 5, that tour of anger, resentment, we got rid of that, right? Fears, we dealt with all that. 8 and 9, guilt, remorse, we got rid of that. Once those things are cleared out of the way, now my relationship with my higher power, I'm feeling it now, right? It says by 10, when we get to 10, our will is aligned with God's will. You know what I mean? We're starting to develop that vital sense. You know what I mean? We're there now, all right? And why are we there, right? We're there because it says by this time we cease fighting anything or anybody, because sanity has returned, right? Because we don't fight like normal people fight, right? You know what I mean? Parking spot, dude battles for his parking spot. He pulls in. Okay, normal people, that guy got the spot. I'll get the next one. You might curse him a little bit, but you get the next one, right? That happens with us. We're jumping out of the car. You know what I mean? A little conflict turns into this giant thing in our head, man, you know? And that's, by definition, if we're battling something, we're insane again. If we're not battling, insanity has returned. So if we are battling, we're insane. And I'm definitely insane when I'm battling. The most important thing, our foundation stone, right? The 12 step. The 12 step. Teaching this stuff to everybody, right? Teaching this stuff to the, you know, the new guys. When they come in, it's our job to pay this debt back. And think about it. The first time I went through the steps, I really didn't know shit. I didn't learn. I learned some things about myself, and I had that spiritual awakening, but I didn't learn the book. I didn't start learning the book until I started teaching it. It was in teaching it that we start to understand. The more you teach it, the more you learn. The more it's up front. If we're attending book studies and we're sitting down with guys and we're taking them through the book, when I get into that conflict in that parking lot or with my ex-wife or whoever, I'm going to react more on a spiritual basis if I'm doing this stuff. It's when I'm not doing it that I'm not going to react in a sane way, right? If it's just like anything else, you know, it's just like guys that go to boot camp because they have to learn how to react in battle. It's the same thing. If I don't learn how to react, if I don't learn how to deal with this sick head, right, because that's where my disease is, there's going to be conflict, man, and I have to deal with it on a spiritual basis. The best thing in the world that ever happened to me was somebody asking me to take a meeting into a recovery house. And I started doing that as soon as I got into the book, and I kept doing it. And I still do meetings on a weekly basis. The recovery house was great because it was a never-ending supply of new guys. You know what I mean? I always had new guys I could sit down with. When I moved up to this area, we started a group, and we were at the Lansdale Church. Then we moved over to 309. and the Unity Clubhouse, and we're there, and we're every week we open up the book, and we break it down a page at a time, a line at a time, and we kick it around, and we ask questions, and we learn, and you know, that's pretty much what my life is about today, is going through this book, getting right with God, and trying to teach it to other guys, and hope that they get it. And with that, that's the end of my story. Thanks for having me.